Salo Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Talofa, Marlo, Bulavanaka, and good morning. This is Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia. It is Monday, March 30. Thanks for tuning in and welcome to the start of another week. We've got a big show coming up today, starting with the US, who has dramatically expanded the area it's considering for seabed mining in one of its Pacific territories.
It not only has eroded trust in this political relationship with the United States, but it has really dampened spirits of many members of our community.
Also, conflict in the Middle East fuels a spike in demand for Pacific dual citizenship. And we sit down with Tonga's new Prime Minister to discuss the challenges of his first months in office.
Those that are affected in the country are not only impacting themselves, but are creating social harm that impacts your community, your family. The social fabric of Tonga is at stake if we are not careful.
We've got all that and more coming up. I'm Kyle Evans. Let's get started. But first, the United States has dramatically expanded the area it's considering opening up for seabed mining in one of its Pacific territories. The area under consideration in the Northern Mariana Islands has now doubled to 69 million acres. As Lucy Cooper reports, the expansion is a blow to local opponents of seabed mining.
The Trump administration is racing to kickstart an American deep-sea mining industry, and the United States' Pacific Territories are on the front line. Sheila Babauta, a former congresswoman for the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands, says the move faces broad opposition in the region.
It is ridiculous. It's so ridiculous. It not only has eroded trust in this political relationship with the United States, but it has really dampened spirits of many members of our community who have put in so much of their time and energy thinking that we would make a difference in the process at this initial stage.
Ms. Babauta is now the chair of Friends of the Mariana Trench, a grassroots non-profit organization. She isn't impressed with the decision to double the expansion area.
Honestly, I rolled my eyes because this process is so flawed. It has caused so much anxiety amongst our community members.
In November, the United States Bureau of Ocean Energy Management issued a request for information, a process which indicated its interest in leasing marine minerals in the CNMI, essentially allowing commercial seabed mining to proceed. BOEM received more than 65,000 submissions and found 326 of these to be substantive. The Bureau then expanded the area recommended for environmental analysis based on the submissions after receiving indications of interest for areas to the west of the Northern Marianas. Sheila Babauta says locals are completely in the dark.
They have hosted zero community meetings or public hearings, and to make a statement saying that this is just part of the process and may not have an impact on deep sea mining and the potential leases, a statement we don't trust. We don't trust this agency and we don't trust this process. By expanding the area of interest, they are opening a wider door to this extractive industry, now closer to our islands, closer to our homeland. It's really frustrating, to say the least, and I think many feel angry.
Angelo Villagomez is a senior fellow for Indigenous-led conservation at the Centre for American Progress. He says his initial reaction to the announcement was one of extreme annoyance.
The Trump administration does not have a lot of support there. This is wildly unpopular. And a rational person would look at how this turned out and would probably think that it would be more appropriate to shrink the area that would be opened to deep sea mining. But they did just the opposite of that.
Right now, China dominates global critical mineral supply chains. But Trump believes his push into seabed mining can change that. Deep sea mining collects polymetallic nodules, which are rock-like lumps filled with critical minerals such as nickel, copper, cobalt, and manganese.
This is just another example of the Trump administration putting corporations and wealthy people ahead of the American people. One of the prime activities of this government has been to sell off America's natural resources to corporations. They are trying to lease offshore areas for oil drilling off the coast of Florida, Texas, and California. There's talks of selling public lands. And this deep sea mining, drill baby drill, this is mine baby mine.
So what happens next? Well, according to Boehm's website, there are six steps. One, publish a request for information and interest. Two, identification of areas which is based on the interest received during the RFI. Three, environmental analysis, which is currently underway. Four, proposed leasing notice. Five, a leasing notice. And six, competitive lease sale. So Boehm will evaluate bids and may award leases. The ABC understands expanding the area identification allows Boehm to consider these areas in its environmental analysis. The area identification itself is not a decision to lease and does not prejudice whether or how the Department of the Interior may proceed with a potential lease sale. Angelo Villagomez hopes deep sea mining won't commence in the waters of US territories.
I've not seen this level of opposition to something in my lifetime. And it's also really interesting the amount of cooperation that's happening between the two territories. You know, this administration has shown that it will do things that defy logic, shall we say, but it has backed away from some of its most unpopular actions. And so one of the best things that we can do from the islands is just show how unpopular this is. And if we can't fight him in the court of public opinion, we will fight them in the courts because they are bound to break the law.
For Sheila Babauta, it's going to be an uphill battle.
Right now, it definitely feels like a fight between David and Goliath. We are not giving up. We are moving forward with ways we can strategize, ways we can gather our allies locally and internationally to raise our voices and stop this extraction of our homelands.
Sheila Babauta, a former congresswoman for the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands and chair of Friends of the Mariana Trench, ending that story from Lucy Cooper. Meanwhile, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management declined the ABC's request for an interview. Well, a parliamentary committee inquiry report into the state of journalism in Papua New Guinea has outlined a raft of concerns. The report cited fears over journalist safety and the rise of AI and impacts bad news has on tourism in the country. Finau Fanua spoke to Neville Choi, president of the Media Council of PNG, to get his insight.
The role of the media in PNG is important. We have a country of citizens who have embraced new media technology, have access to new technology that can be misused in a whole lot of ways. And I think we're at a point where we need to educate our citizens more on how to use media effectively. And I think there is a certain level of minimum standard of respect on social media that we can try to help alleviate. So that everybody's being more responsible and more respectful of each other.
What's your judgment on the inquiry? Do you think it was comprehensive?
Yes, I think it was to some point comprehensive. I mean, they went around the country and consulted citizens, they consulted civil society. In the case of the media, I think every media organization also made representations. The Media Council has had constant contact with the Special Parliamentary Committee on Communications. We made it a point to attend as many of their regional consultation hearings as possible. And I think many of our concerns and industries' suggestions on how to approach some of the current issues we have around misinformation and disinformation, they're all captured in the committee's final report.
One thing that was pointed out, and it's not a surprise, we see it across the Pacific, is how social media is the primary source of news in Papua New Guinea.
As president of the Media Council, I think the issue that concerns me about is the fact that social media is still very highly unregulated as opposed to mainstream media. And if we have our citizens going to social media as their first stop for news and information, our call from the Media Council is for our citizens to pause and take a step back and try and do their own fact-checking on every piece of information they come across, and not just relying on social media.
And then there's the issue of AI. Is that a concern for the Media Council?
It has been a concern, and mostly for the Media Council and for mainstream media. The issues around AI is to either fully understand it and its use and prospects of being used in the media, and also educating our audiences about what's out there with AI, empowering them with the information and awareness on how to detect AI-generated content.
Another thing that was mentioned was how the media industry, according to this inquiry, has been damaged by biased reporting and leading to public mistrust. Do you think that's a problem?
I mean, it has been a problem, but it's not solely a problem that's been generated by the media or by media organizations specifically. The issue that the council that we've seen is the media only gets, and universities only get, students from the national education system. So clearly, if we aren't getting graduates who are fully prepared to hit the ground running when they get into the mainstream, there must be an issue with the education system, which has already been widely acknowledged. And of course, the focus on journalism training is to improve journalism training so that their graduates are industry ready.
And then there's the issue of press freedom, which is the biggest concern for media all over the world. According to this inquiry, there are calls for constitutional reform to strengthen guarantees for freedom of information and editorial independence. Do you think press freedom is being threatened in Papua New Guinea?
I wouldn't say it's being threatened here in PNG. I think the reason for us pushing press freedom is that in the Papua New Guinea National Constitution, there is only one clause, which is a general clause on freedom of expression, that covers the media. There is no specific mention or clause in the PNG National Constitution which specifically refers to the protection of press freedom or media freedom per se. So our suggestion and what we've been discussing is to decouple media freedom or press freedom from freedom of expression and have it stand alone in our constitution as its own clause specifically for the protection of media freedom.
One thing that also I found very interesting was concerns over Papua New Guinea's international image being undermined. And, you know, from my experience reporting on Papua New Guinea, it seems to be dominated by bad news. And I've had complaints from friends in Papua New Guinea about the need for more positive news. Is it a problem? And how do we resolve this?
I think I can best put it this way, Fina. If everything was happening the way it should be, we wouldn't have bad news. So the media here in PNG, we do play a role in highlighting to government or to authorities about what's not being done. Now, that may take the form of bad news, but it's not solely for profit. There's a very strong and ethical issue that media organizations face, that we feel that at some point we have to highlight what's happening, even though it's bad, so that some good can happen.
From the Media Council's point of view, what is the biggest challenge for journalists and the media in Papua New Guinea?
The biggest obstacle I see right now to the media here in PNG is just citizens' understanding of how the media works, national leaders' understanding of how the media works, and the understanding that we are not in this alone as the media. We are in this to work for the betterment of the future of our people and the development of our country. And sometimes when things do not work or go right, we have to highlight them. And sometimes that takes the form of bad news. The report shows that there's a conscious and positive and proactive shift to make sure and establish the media as a necessary part of democracy in PNG. And what it means is we have a lot more work now to do with regards to the recommendations in the report. But from where I sit, I think the media, and according to the show, but I think the media in PNG will be in a better, stronger place
we don't see parliamentary inquiries on media from in other countries. So it is a positive in that sense, right?
Oh, yes, very positive. Because this whole process began as national leadership wanting to understand the media better, not just to protect media freedom, but also to make sure that government information that media had access to was clear, verified, and would support development. It's been a really long period of engagement with the parliamentary committee. I think the industry in PNG has achieved some level of acknowledgement from government that the work of media in PNG is extremely important.
That was Neville Choi, President of the Media Council of PNG. He was speaking there to the ABC's Finau Fanua. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, conflict in the Middle East is fueling a spike in demand for dual citizenship, according to the head of Nauru's Economic and Climate Resilience Citizenship Program. The Citizenship by Investment Scheme allows people to apply for a Nauruan passport by making a significant financial contribution to the country. Joining us now is the head of that program, Edward Clark. Edward, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me and good morning to you.
Not a problem at all. It's an interesting story, this one. So how much of an increase in interest is Nauruan citizenship? How much interest have you seen?
We've had probably, I would say, initially a small increase, but what is more evident is the number of increasing inquiries we are now getting from the Middle East. It takes some time for applicants to obviously gather all of the necessary documentation. And so because of the increase in inquiries, this typically translates or flows through to an increase in volume. So I'd say we're yet to see a significant increase, but the inquiries have increased significantly.
I see. And are there any particular countries that the interest is mainly coming from?
We have already got quite an established presence or I guess market reputation in countries like Kuwait. So we've had Kuwait currently makes up or is the second largest driver of volume for applications for the Nauru citizenship program.
I see. So I understand it's been the threat of conflict that's driving a lot of this interest. Can you explain, I guess, how the threat of that conflict is prompting people to consider a second citizenship? Like, what reasons have you heard?
Yeah, so the driver is primarily because it provides optionality to people with dual citizenship. And I'll give you an example, and you can only look to cases like in Ukraine where this has actually played out in recent years. And that is where, if conflict does break out, often countries will restrict people from their own of their own nationality from leaving the country. And also there's the risk of mandatory conscription. So I think what a lot of the applicants are seeking is having that optionality or effectively like an insurance plan, which may, not necessarily, but may give them an exit plan in a time of need, and it may help them to avoid something like military conscription.
Yeah, I can certainly understand that as a motivator, and I guess if they are able to secure citizenship in a place like Nauru, does that also prevent them from being extradited back to the country that they might have come from?
It's an interesting question. I mean, extradition laws are complicated and beyond my area of expertise, but I would imagine it would be quite challenging to extradite someone just for them to then have to serve in the military, as an example.
Yes, no, I understand that. And is there a certain demographic of people, I guess, that you've seen who are expressing the most interest? I mean, look, I imagine somewhat wealthy people would be one, but are we talking young people, like perhaps parents, you know, seeking refuge for their children? Like, is there any particular demographic you can point to?
We have seen quite a lot from the Middle East, large families applying, and the Nauru Citizenship Program has quite a family-friendly approach. A lot of the other citizenship programs have restrictions on certain family members applying. For example, if they're over a certain age or if they're not financially dependent. So we do see quite a large number of applications from family members. Because we have an inclusive family approach, yes, absolutely, it's parents wanting to get security for their children, and that is what we've seen the most. And in fact, we already have applicants, even our first applicant, which was a German family, wanted that insurance plan for their children.
Right. So when you say a friendly family approach, is that like sort of a... You sort of like a package deal for, say, two parents and children or something like that?
Not a package deal. We just don't have so many restrictions on allowing family members to apply. So, for example, if you wanted to apply for a citizenship program in the Caribbean, they restrict children from being included in the application if they're over the age of 30, as an example.
Oh, right.
Or if they're in paid employment, or if they're married, and we don't have any of those restrictions. So we will allow people to apply as families without restricting anyone if they don't meet that criteria.
I see. It is Monday, March 30, and you're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Kyle Evans, and I'm chatting to the head of Nauru's Economic and Climate Resilience Citizenship Program, Edward Clark, about a spike in demand for dual citizenship. Now, we spoke to you after the first successful candidates were granted Nauruan citizenship. How many people now have Nauruan passports under the program?
We have over 20 successful citizenships having been granted, and we have a pipeline of over 100 applications at the moment. So we've seen quite a significant shift in application volume, and this really started triggering around September last year and has been steady in terms of volume since then.
Oh, I see. And in Australia, Nauru is known as the place where asylum seekers have been sent for offshore processing. Has this coloured the perception of the citizenship by investment scheme at all from, I guess, foreign applicants?
I don't think so. I mean, we very rarely get questions about it. And I think because we don't expect many of the citizens to actually be residing in Nauru, for example, it doesn't come up as a major concern.
I see. And I suppose just on that, so does that mean they don't have to move to Nauru if they are granted citizenship? It's just an option they have, I guess, in their back pocket if they ever want to exercise it?
Exactly. And it may just be, I mean, the entire process can be conducted entirely remote and there is no residency requirement. So yes, like I said earlier, it's more of an insurance plan. So yes, they may want to relocate to Nauru as a contingency, but more likely it's because of the other benefits that dual citizenship provides them, like what we talked about it before, having that backup plan. The other thing that we've seen a lot is driven by mobility. Mm. For example, being able to travel more freely to certain countries. And a recent example of that is a Bangladeshi businessman who's been operating in Singapore as an executive in the banking sector. And he's just started his new venture. And he wants to travel to certain jurisdictions, but as a Bangladeshi, it's very challenging for him to get a visa. So this will be a real door opener in terms of him being able to expand his business.
I guess prior to all the conflict that we've seen in the Middle East, like where would the majority of your applicants come from? Would it sort of be the Asia region, or was it still sort of the Middle Eastern region, even before the wars broke out?
We have had applicants from over 20 different countries, so the diversity is quite broad, but yes, certainly China is the biggest driver of volume, and that is true no matter where you look, purely because of the population size.
No, that's understandable. Now, critics of the citizen by investment scheme say they can attract organised criminals and people like oligarchs seeking to evade foreign law enforcement and things like that. Obviously, there was the issue with Andrew Tate and his Vanuatu citizenship a short time ago. Is that a concern for you or the Nauru government?
Well, look, it is a risk of operating a program like that, and we have seen applicants that do have criminal backgrounds try and apply. We have had people try and apply with forged documentation, such as a clean police clearance certificate, which we were able to identify was fraudulent. And we have had applicants apply that we suspect are involved in criminal activity. And while it is a risk, we have a very robust due diligence process, and in terms of the evidence that we require to be able to demonstrate that the source of funds and source of wealth and overall backgrounds of the individuals is very robust, and that enables us to effectively filter out the bad actors from those that are genuine and have gained their wealth legitimately. So I'm very pleased to be able to say, you know, our due diligence process is working very well. Yes, it is always a risk, but I'm very pleased with how those controls have been performing to date.
Out of curiosity, without getting too far into the weeds, but yeah, what kind of things do you have to provide to be granted citizenship? Obviously, you know, beyond your typical, you know, identification documents and things like that.
It's quite extensive. So, yes, we do require multiple forms of identification, but we also require, for example, if you're a business owner, we require a lot of documentation relating to those businesses. We require bank statements to be able to evidence where funds are coming from. We'll often require tax certificates if certain situations are not clear, to be able to demonstrate that the applicants are you know, paying tax correctly. We require health certificates to evidence that they are not going to be a potential burden on the Nauru health system as well. It really can depend a lot on the applicant's individual circumstances and where the risks lie. We'll often look at, you know, court documents, as an example, if they've been involved in civil litigation, to assess the kind of risk related to that as well. So it can be very extensive.
Yeah, it certainly is interesting, that's for sure. We'll leave it there, Edward, because we are running out of time. But thanks so much for joining us today on Pacific Beat. And, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing where the program goes from here.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That was Edward Clark, the CEO of Nauru's Economic and Climate Resilience Citizenship Program.
What's up, ABC Radio Australia listeners? I'm Sosafina Formoli, and I want you to come hang with me for On The Record, your weekly deep dive into the music that moves the Pacific. We'll talk about the big tracks that inspire your favourite Pacific music artists and the real stories behind them. Plus, we'll uncover some gems that you might not know yet, keeping the heart of the Pacific alive and thumping. Catch On The Record Mondays at 3 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
It's time to take a look at what's making headlines around the Pacific region. And to do that, I'm joined by our producer, Dana Kerimov. Dana, how are you this morning?
I'm good, Kyle. How are you?
I am well. I am well. Another Monday morning coming up to Easter. So I guess the countdown is on in that sense, isn't it? Now, let's start in Fiji this morning. So former Fijian president Ratu Neletinau died on Thursday, aged 84.
Yeah, so Ratu Epele Neletinau, he was a chief and former Fiji military commander before he served as president from 2009 to 2015. He also served as Speaker of Parliament after that from 2019 to 2022. Local media reported that he passed away at the Suva Private Hospital after being admitted earlier that day on Thursday evening. His death was pretty unexpected and left many in shock, as he was a pretty well-loved figure. Fiji's former Attorney General, Ayaz Saeed Kayum, described him as the people's president. So people were pretty cut up.
To the Solomon Islands now. So Ministry of Health and Medical Services is urging the public to stop drinking a particular kind of, what's this, coffee, sachet coffee?
Yeah, so it's a kind of sachet coffee, which is just a coffee you get in a little bag and then you rip open and mix with water. The ministry, they've issued a statement urging particularly men to refrain from drinking the Saba brand Miracle Energy coffee. This is after they sent it to the Australian Therapeutic Goods Administration for analysis, and they found that a single sachet contains three times the recommended dose of tadalafil. Now, tadalafil is not inherently harmful, but it is a prescription-only drug, and if you have pre-existing medical conditions, it can have particularly cardiovascular side effects, and it also can interact with any kind of medications you're already taking.
Right, so perhaps not the Miracle Energy coffee.
No. I mean, some might find it a miracle, but you don't want to take it without knowing what it does.
And New Caledonia's domestic airline, Air Caledonian, has filed for bankruptcy.
Yeah, so at a meeting on Friday, the board of directors decided to file for bankruptcy following almost a month of blockades by its customers. The protest movement opposed the company's decision to move Air Caledonia's operations from the Noumea Magenta Airport to New Caledonia's International La Tontuta base, which is more than 50 kilometres away from Noumea City, which is the capital. The blockades effectively grounded all of Air Caledonia's aircrafts since March 2nd, so it's been about a month.
Yeah, look, that's obviously quite sad. The territory has been through a lot in the last couple of years, so I'm not surprised that that the airline has felt the effects of that. And let's hope the impact isn't too large on its on New Caledonia's tourism economy. So does this mean the company is gone? Like, where do we go from here?
Not necessarily. One of the options, if approved by a tribunal, could allow the resumption of operations down the line, so it's not the end. The company said that under the proposed process, all debts will be frozen, and provided it's allowed to resume inter-island flights, so between different islands, Air Caledonia could continue operating. But if the plan isn't approved, it could mean that an order for the company there would be an order for the company to go into receivership, which is where someone is appointed to sell company assets to recover owed debts.
Yeah, we have seen that take place quite a bit with airlines, both in the Pacific and even in Australia in recent times. So let's hope it doesn't come to that. Dana, thanks so much for bringing us those stories this morning.
Thank you, Carl.
That was our producer, Dana Kerimov. It is Monday, March 30, and you're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Kyle Evans, and if you're just tuning in, we're going to pause for a quick recap of today's stories. The US has dramatically expanded the area it's considering for seabed mining in one of its Pacific territories.
It not only has eroded trust in this political relationship with the United States, but it has really dampened spirits of many members of our community.
Meanwhile, conflict in the Middle East has fueled a spike in demand for Pacific dual citizenship, and a parliamentary committee inquiry into the state of journalism in Papua New Guinea cites fears over journalist safety and the rise of AI.
We're at a point where we need to educate our citizens more on how to use media effectively. And I think there is a certain level of minimum standard of respect on social media that we can try to help alleviate so that everybody's being more responsible and more respectful of each other.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, Tonga's new Prime Minister says one of his biggest tasks in the first days of his administration has been to unite pro-democracy and noble members of parliament. Lord Whakaafenua became one of the youngest PMs in the country's history when his fellow MPs voted him into office 4 months ago. He's only the second noble Prime Minister since democratic reforms in the kingdom in 2010. Lord Whakaafenua sat down for a one-on-one interview with our Tongan reporter, Marion Kupu.
The constitution allows for 9 nobles representatives to be elected into parliament and 17 people's representatives to be elected from the people's 17 constituencies. I ran as a candidate not just as a candidate for the nobility, but as a candidate from Tonga, as a Tongan citizen, and as a member of parliament representing Hapai. I ran against the former prime minister and won fair and square in a very transparent process that's very democratic.
You did mention in the beginning that you wanted to unite the parliament. How has that been going?
Since parliament opened and we swore in the members of cabinet, parliament members, and also appointed the chairs of all the select committees in parliament, we haven't met yet. But I am quite confident that a lot of the unity that we are talking about at the start, from the outset, has already begun in terms of Hapai, being the first Prime Minister from Hapai. I'm very proud to say that the Hapai Development Committee has already met. We have some priority agendas for the people of Hapai, and despite what people are saying in terms of the relationship that me as a member of nobility and from Hapai, we are working together and very closely with the two representatives from Hapai 12 and 13. In the coming weeks and in the next few months, we'll be delivering street lights, solar lights to the communities in Hapai, as well as outboard motors, engines that would support the local fisheries, not just in our estate as noble representatives, but also in the constituencies for Hapai 12 and Hapai 13. So I think that's part of the tangible results of the unity that we're working with. And apart from the unity we have in government and our cabinet, we're extending that to local government and through non-cabinet members in Hapai.
Let's step into the other shady, darker side of Tonga, which involves with drugs. Drug is a growing issue here in Tonga. How serious is it to you?
The issue with illicit drugs in Tonga is the fact that those that are affected in the country are not only impacting themselves, but are creating social harm that impacts your community, your family. The social fabric of Tonga is at stake if we are not careful. And so the government has a three-pronged approach: supply reduction, demand reduction, and harm reduction. And evidently, what we've experienced is that the work that the government has been doing, both the current government and previous governments on supply reduction, is working. The amount of illicit drugs that is captured around the region is due to the cooperation of interagencies, not just in the Pacific, but in the wider region. That sharing of intelligence has captured drugs that were destined for Tonga, through Tonga, into Australia and New Zealand. And the amount of prosecutions and the successful results of those investigations has meant that we are now seeing more lifers in jail and Dolly Dolly than in the history of Tonga. And that's a result of the work that we've been doing on supply reduction. My focus now with the Illicit Drugs Task Force is to move and focus less, even though it's as important and the work is still ongoing, on supply, but more on demand and harm reduction. And for the first time since we called the first meeting this year of the Illicit Drugs Task Force, we involved the non-government organizations. And in allocating the $5 million that is budgeted by the government for harm and supply and demand reduction, we'll be involving directly the non-government organizations. And this is also timely because last year, the government and parliament approved the Youth Diversion Program, which means that youth are now diverted from the courts back to their communities. So working with non-government organizations such as the Salvation Army will be handling the children and the future of Tonga outside of the legal system so that their opportunities for getting work, for getting visas, for travel, is not compromised because of a record and because of the poor decisions that they've made in the past. So we're focusing on harm, and on top of the supply reduction, we're focusing on harm reduction and demand reduction.
Tonga's Prime Minister Lord Whakaafenua speaking there to the ABC's Marian Kupu about his first 4 months in office.
Want the latest Pacific Rugby League and Union news and interviews with stars of the game? Tune in to Nation Footy with Sam Wykes and Tinirau Arona.
Oh, you've been the PNG, eh?
We've got to make sure the listeners know that we love them as well.
So then when we go to the Cook Islands, so how do we get to the Cook Islands?
Bosses, anyone listening?
Nation Footy, Monday afternoons at 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. In French Polynesia, a team of historical archaeologists have used an advanced dating method to create the first precise construction timeline for houses built out of coral on Mangareva Island. French Catholic missionaries first introduced the building technique to indigenous Mangarevans in the 1830s. As a result, these coral structures provide unique insight into the flashpoint of colonization for southeast French Polynesia. Rather than the better-known radiocarbon dating using the more precise uranium theorem dating method, this new detailed timeline has the potential to enable historical archaeologists to better understand how colonization impacts local cultures across the globe. Dana Karimov spoke to James Flexner, an associate professor at the University of Sydney, who led the team on this study.
The difference between uranium-thorium dating and radiocarbon is, even with a really good radiocarbon date, your error ranges tend to be in the range of sort of plus or minus 20, plus or minus 50 years. With uranium thorium dating, the error ranges go right down to single digits, plus or minus 2, plus or minus 4. And unlike radiocarbon dating, which stops being particularly useful for archaeologists on sites that are less than about 300 or 400 years old, the method works right up until the present. The missionaries, of course, were very good at writing down when they were building their buildings. What we don't know is when the Mangarevans were building their houses, sometime between the 1830s and the 1870s. And so this provided us with an opportunity to get some independent dates to help us to assess the approximate ages when we think these structures were built and get an independent line of evidence that also helped us to interpret some of the things that we were finding in our excavated materials.
When you were on Pacific Beat just over 2 years ago, you said that the ancient sacred mantles had likely been dismantled by missionaries, and then the materials had been used to build churches and other sort of structures like that. And now with the use of this dating method, it seems that that isn't the case anymore. Why is that finding significant?
So it tells a slightly different story, and it tells a different story about the relationship to previous sacred landscapes in the islands than maybe what we had initially hypothesized a few years ago, which, you know, that's part of the kind of scientific process.
The use of coral to build structures really only has a brief history. Why is it that this 40-year period in French Polynesia, a century and a half ago, is so important to study? What is it about that time?
For southeastern French Polynesia, which is where the Mangareva Islands are, this is the first long-term European settlement. This is a period when life really changed quite dramatically for Mangarevan people. From Mangareva, this method of coral construction gets adapted to a lot of the neighboring island groups. This was an introduced construction technique that was adapted and appropriated by Polynesians to kind of be their own way of constructing domestic spaces in their islands, which continued to evolve from the sort of earlier ancestral forms that they had been building for a very long time up to this point.
This new form of dating, is this an opportunity to be able to look into that area and that population's way of life simply because we don't have written record of it now?
For me, you know, this is kind of one of the driving forces behind my research, is the idea that not everyone appears in the archive in the same way. The material record is the one thing that everyone has in common. Doesn't matter if you're a king, queen, earl, whatever, or the poorest peasant in society, we all leave our garbage behind. I think that's kind of the key to writing Pacific histories in particular, is thinking about all of the people whose names are not prominent in an archival record, who were nonetheless prominent people within their communities and within their times, who may not have left a written record, but maybe they've left behind a different kind of record that let us reconstruct this world that no longer exists. And I think critically, to think about what that means for the present, because here we are in the 21st century, and the story is, you know, we're facing unprecedented times, whether we're talking about climate change or international instability or all the things that are prominent in the headlines now. And I think a point that those of us who work on longer term histories need to keep making is, in a sense, none of this is new. It's not the first time that, for example, Polynesians have faced major upheavals in the form of, say, mass migration. It's not the first time that foreigners have come in to interfere in the lives of islanders. And I think the point to make is, even with all of that being true over the last few centuries, the Polynesians are still there. And they're still going to be there hundreds of years and thousands of years into the future. And the things that were adaptive, whether that's being able to be accommodating of different kinds of belief systems, being able to stand up for themselves and resist some of these foreign actors, all of these strategies that worked in the past continue to be adaptive for Pacific Islanders in the present and into the future. So, you know, I try to, when I'm talking to people in the islands, connect the things that we do that are about history and about what happened before to things that are happening now, so they can point to things when various outsiders are coming in and saying, you people need this, you people need that. They can say, look, we have this. It's here. It's right here on the ground. You don't need to tell us who we are or where we came from. And the more we can do to help them to document what they have and value it and preserve it for future generations, that's, you know, one of the positives that archaeology as a discipline can do in the region when we're helping people to manage their cultural heritage.
That was Associate Professor James Flexner speaking to Darnet Kerimoff. And that does bring us to the end of Pacific Beat today. Recapping our top story, the United States has doubled the area it's considering opening up for deep sea mining in one of its Pacific territories. In a blow to local opponents of seabed mining, the area under construction in the Northern Mariana Islands has now been expanded to 69 million acres.
This process is so flawed. It has caused so much anxiety amongst our community members.
We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. My name's Kyle Evans. Have a fantastic day.